"He will know," Lotherin replied, his voice very weak now.
"Now, Jax, the ambassador to the court at Vomimbre. He is the personal representative of Taurogas, King of the Murkos."
Geryon was stunned at the implications of that.
"He has got all the gold from the bottomless mines of Tor Murkos at his command. The plot he gave my friends and me could just be one of a dozen or more, all aimed at destroying Orindia. You have got to stop him, Geryon. Promise me."
The pale young man's eyes were feverish, and his grip on Geryon's hand was tightening.
"I'll stop him, Lothran. I don't know how yet, but one way or another I will stop him."
Lothran sank weakly back on the litter, his strength seeming to run out as if the necessity for extracting that promise had been the only thing sustaining him.
"Goodbye, Lothran,"
Geryon said softly, his eyes filling with tears.
"Goodbye, my friend,"
Lothran barely more than whispered. Then his eyes closed, and the hand gripping Geryon's went limp. Geryon stared at him with a dreadful fear, until he saw the faint flutter of his pulse in the hollow of his throat. Lothran was still alive, if only barely. Geryon tenderly put down his friend's hand, and pulled the rough, gray blanket up around his shoulders. Then he stood up and walked quickly away with tears running down his cheeks. The rest of the farewells were brief, and they remounted and rode at a trot toward the Great West Road. There were a few cheers from the serfs and pikemen as they passed, but in the distance there was another sound. The women from the villages had come out to search for their men among the bodies littering the field, and their wails and shrieks mocked the cheers. With deliberate purpose, Geryon pushed his horse forward until he drew in beside Mandorallan.
"I have something to say to you," he said hotly. "You're not going to like it, but I don't really care."
"Oh," the knight replied mildly.
"I think the way you talked to Lothran back there was cruel and disgusting. You might think you are the greatest knight in the world, but I think you're a loud-mouthed braggart with no more compassion than a block of stone, and if you don't like it, what do you plan to do about it?"
"Ah," Mandorallan said, "that. I think that thou hast misunderstood, my young friend. It was necessary in order to save his life. The Asturian youth is very brave, and so gives no thought to himself. Had I not spoken so to him, he would surely have insisted upon continuing with us, and would soon have died."
"Died?" Geryon scoffed. "And Paul could have cured him?"
"It was the Lady Polgara herself who informed me that his life was in danger," Mandorallan replied. "His honor would not permit him to seek proper care, but that same honor prevailed upon him to remain behind, lest he delay us."
The knight smiled wryly.
"He will, I think, be no fonder of me for my words than thou art, but he will be alive, and that is what matters, is it not?"
Geryon stared at the arrogant-seeming Mimbrate, his anger suddenly robbed of its target. With painful clarity, he realized that he had just made a fool of himself.
"I'm sorry,"
he apologized grudgingly.
"I didn't realize what you were doing."
Mandorallan shrugged.
It is not important. I am frequently misunderstood. As long as I know what my motives are, and that they are good, however, I am seldom very concerned with the opinions of others. I am glad, though, that I have the opportunity to explain this to thee. Thou art to be my companion, and it ill behooves companions to have misapprehensions about each other."
They rode on in silence as Geryon struggled to readjust his thinking. There was, it seemed, much more to Mandorallan than he had suspected. They reached the highway then and turned south again, under a threatening sky. Chapter 8.
The Arendish Plain was a vast rolling grassland, only sparsely settled. The wind sweeping across the dried grass was raw and chill. Dirty-looking clouds scudded overhead as they rode on. The necessity for leaving the injured Leldoran behind had put them all into a melancholy mood, and, for the most part, they traveled in silence for the next several days. Geryon rode at the rear with Hetar and the pack horses, doing his best to stay away from Mandrollen. Hetar was a silent man, who seemed undisturbed by hours of riding without conversation. But after 2 days of this, Geryon made a deliberate effort to draw the hawk-faced Algar out.
"Why is it that you hate the Murgos so much, Hetar?"
he asked, for want of something better to say.
"All Elons hate Murgos,"
Hetar answered quietly.
"Yes," Geryon admitted, "but it seems to be something personal with you. Why is that?"
Hetar shifted in his saddle, his leather clothing creaking.
"They killed my parents," he replied.
Geryon felt a sudden shock as the Algar's words struck a responsive note.
"How did it happen?"
He asked it before he realized that Hetar might prefer not to talk about it.
"I was 7,
Hetar told him, in an unemotional voice.
"We were going to visit my mother's family. She was from a different clan. We had to pass near the eastern escarpment, and a Murgo raiding party caught us. My mother's horse stumbled, and she was thrown. The Murgos were on us before my father and I could get her back onto her horse. They took a long time to kill my parents. I remember that my mother screamed once near the end."
The Algar's face was as bleak as a rock, and his flat, quiet voice made his story seem that much more dreadful.
"After my parents were dead, the Murgos tied a rope around my feet and dragged me behind one of their horses. When the rope finally broke, they thought I was dead, and they all rode off. They were laughing about it, as I recall. Tohag found me a couple of days later."
As clearly as if he had been there, Geryon had a momentary picture of a child, dreadfully injured and alone, wandering in the emptiness of eastern Algeria with only grief and a terrible hatred keeping him alive.
"I killed my first Murgo when I was 10,
Hetar went on in that same flat voice.
"He was trying to escape from us, and I rode him down and put a javelin between his shoulders. He screamed when the javelin went through him. That made me feel better. Kohag thought that if he made me watch the Murgo die, it might cure me of the hatred. He was wrong about that, though."
The tall Algar's face was expressionless, and his wind-whipped scalp lock tossed and flowed out behind him. There was a kind of emptiness about him, as if he were devoid of any feeling but that one driving compulsion. For an instant, Geryon dimly understood what Mr. Wolf had been driving at when he had warned about the danger of becoming obsessed with a desire for revenge. But he pushed the notion out of his mind. If Hetar could live with it, so could he. He felt a sudden fierce admiration for this lonely hunter in black leather. Mr. Wolf was deep in conversation with Mandrollen, and the two of them loitered until Hetar and Geryon caught up with them. For a time, they rode along together.
"It is our nature,"
the knight in his gleaming armor was saying in a melancholy voice.
"We are overproud. And it is our pride that dooms our poor Arendia to internecine war."
"That can be cured,"
Mr. Wolf said.
"How?" Mandrollen asked. "It is in our blood. I myself am the most peaceful of men. But even I am subject to our national disease. Moreover, our divisions are too great, too buried in our history, and our souls to be purged away.
The peace will not last, my friend. Even now Asturian arrows sing in the forests, seeking Mimbre targets, and Mimbre, in reprisal, burns Asturian houses and butchers the hostages. War is inevitable, I fear.
No, Wolf disagreed. It's not.
But how may it be prevented? Mandarallan demanded. Who can cure our insanity?
I will, if I have to,
Wolf told him quietly, pushing back his gray hood. Mandarallan smiled wanly.
I appreciate thy good intentions, Belgarath, but that is impossible, even for thee.
Nothing is actually impossible, Mandarallan,
Wolf answered in a matter-of-fact voice.
Most of the time, I prefer not to interfere with other people's amusements. But I can't afford to have Arindia going up in flames just now. If I have to, I will step in and put a stop to any more foolishness.
Hast thou in truth such power?
Mandarallan asked somewhat wistfully, as if he could not quite bring himself to believe it.
Yes,
Wolf replied prosaically, scratching at his short white beard.
As a matter of fact, I do.
Mandarallan's face grew troubled, even a bit awed, at the old man's quiet statement. And Geryon found his grandfather's declaration profoundly disturbing. If Wolf could actually stop a war single-handedly, he would have no difficulty at all thwarting Geryon's own plans for revenge. It was something else to worry about. Then Silk rode back toward them.
The Great Fair's just ahead, the rat-faced man announced. Do we want to stop, or should we go around it?
We might as well stop. It's almost evening, and we need some supplies,
Wolf decided.
The horses could use some rest, too,
Hetar said.
They are starting to complain.
You should have told me,
Wolf said, glancing back at the pack train.
They are not really in bad shape yet,
Hetar informed him.
But they are starting to feel sorry for themselves. They are exaggerating, of course, but a little rest would not hurt them.
Exaggerating? Silk sounded shocked.
You don't mean to say that horses can actually lie, do you?
Hetar shrugged.
Of course. They lie all the time. They are very good at it.
For a moment, Silk looked outraged at the thought, and then he suddenly laughed.
Somehow, that restores my faith in the order of the universe, he declared.
Wolf looked pained.
Silk, he said pointedly, you are a very evil man. Did you know that?
Oh, one does one's best, Silk replied mockingly.
The Arendish Fair lay at the intersection of the Great West Road and the mountain track leading down out of Ogoland. It was a vast collection of blue, red, and yellow tents, and broad-striped pavilions, stretching for a league or more in every direction. It appeared like a brightly hued city in the midst of the dun-colored plain, and its brilliant pennons snapped bravely in the endless wind under a lowering sky.
I hope I'll have time to do some business,
Silk said, as they rode down a long hill toward the fair. The little man's sharp nose was twitching now.
I'm starting to get out of practice.
A half-dozen mud-smeared beggars crouched miserably beside the road, their hands outstretched. Mandarallan paused and scattered some coins among them.
You shouldn't encourage them,
Merrick growled.
Charity is both a duty and a privilege, my lord Barak,
Mandarallan replied.
Why don't they build houses here?
Geryon asked Silk, as they approached the central part of the fair.
Oh, nobody stays here that long, Silk explained.
The fair is always here, but the population is very fluid. Besides, buildings are taxed. Tents are not. Many of the merchants who came out of their tents to watch the party pass seemed to know Silk, and some of them greeted him warily, suspicion plainly written on their faces. Barak observed dryly,
I see that your reputation's preceded you, Silk.
Silk shrugged.
The price of fame.
Isn't there some danger that somebody will recognize you as that other merchant?
Durnick asked. The one the Murgos are looking for? You mean Ambar? Oh, it's not very likely. Ambar does not come to our India very often, and he and Redek don't look a bit alike.
But they're the same man, Durnick objected. They're both you.
Ah, Silk said, raising a finger. You and I both know that, but they do not. To you I always look like myself, but to others I look quite different.
Durnick looked profoundly skeptical.
Redek, old friend,
a bald Drasnian merchant called from a nearby tent.
Delvor, Silk replied delightedly. I haven't seen you in years.
You look prosperous, the bald man observed.
Oh, getting by, Silk responded modestly. What are you dealing in now?
I've got a few Malorian carpets, Delvor told him. Some of the local nobles are interested, but they don't like the price.
His hands, however, were already speaking of other matters. Your uncle sent out word that we were to help you if necessary. Do you need anything?
What are you carrying in your packs?
He asked aloud.
Sindarian woolens, Silk answered, and a few other odds and ends. Have you seen any Murgos here at the fair?
The hands continued flying. One, but he left for Vomimbre a week ago. There are some Nadraks on the far side of the fair, though.
They're a long way from home, Silk gestured.
Are they really in business? Delvor answered. It's hard to say.
Can you put us up for a day or so?
I'm sure we can work out something, Delvor replied with a sly twinkle in his eyes and a flick in his hands. Silk's fingers betrayed his shock at the suggestion.
Business is business, after all, Delvor gestured.
You must come aside, he said aloud. Take a cup of wine, have some supper.
We have years of catching up to do.
We'd be delighted, Silk returned somewhat sourly.
Could it be that you've met your match, Prince Keldar?
Aunt Paul inquired softly, with a faint smile, as the little man helped her down from her horse in front of Delvor's brightly striped pavilion.
Delvor? Hardly. He's been trying to get even with me for years, ever since a ploy of mine in your Gorak cost him a fortune. I'll let him think he's got me for a while, though. It will make him feel good. And I will enjoy it that much more when I pull the rug out from under him.
She laughed.
You're incorrigible.
He winked back at her. The interior of Delvor's main pavilion was ruddy in the light of several glowing braziers that put out a welcome warmth. The floor was covered with a deep blue carpet, and large red cushions were scattered here and there to sit upon. Once they were inside, Silk quickly made the introductions.
I am honored, Ancient One,
Delvor murmured, bowing deeply to Mr. Wolf and then to Aunt Paul.
What can I do to help?
Wolf replied, Right now, we need information more than anything. He pulled off his heavy cloak.
We ran into a Grawlum stirring up trouble a few days north of here. Can you nose about and find out what's happening between here and Vomimbre? I'd like to avoid any more neighborhood squabbles, if possible.
I will make the inquiries, Delvor promised.
I'll be moving around, too, Silk said.
Between us, Delvor and I should be able to sift out most of the loose information in the fair.
Wolf looked at him inquiringly.
Redek of Boktor never passes up a chance to do business, the little man explained, just a bit too quickly. It would look very strange if he stayed in Delvor's tent.
I see, Wolf said.
We wouldn't want anything to spoil our disguise now, would we?
Silk asked innocently. His long nose, however, was twitching even more violently. Wolf surrendered.
All right, but don't get exotic. I don't want a crowd of outraged customers outside this tent in the morning howling for your head.
Delvor's porters took the packs from the spare horses, and one of them showed Hetar the way to the horse pens on the outskirts of the fair. Silk began rummaging through the packs. A myriad of small, expensive items began to pile up on Delvor's carpet, as Silk's quick hands dipped into the corners and folds of the wool cloth.
"I wondered why you needed so much money in Kamar," Wolf commented dryly.
"Oh, just part of the disguise," Silk replied. "Riddick always has a few curios with him for trade along the way."
"That's a very convenient explanation," Barak observed. "But I wouldn't run it into the ground if I were you."
"If I can't double our old friend's money in the next hour, I'll retire permanently," Silk promised. "Oh, I almost forgot. I'll need Geryon to act as a porter for me. Riddick always has at least one porter." "Try not to corrupt him too much," Aunt Paul said.
Silk bowed extravagantly and set his black velvet cap at a jaunty angle. With Geryon at his heels, carrying a stout sack of his treasures, he swaggered out onto the great Arendish fair like a man going into battle. A fat Tolnedron, 3/10 down the way, proved troublesome, and succeeded in getting a jeweled dagger away from Silk for only 3 times what it was worth. But 2 Arendish merchants in a row bought identical silver goblets at prices which, though widely different, more than made up for the setback.
"I love to deal with errands," Silk gloated as they moved on down the muddy streets between the pavilions.
The sly little Drasnian moved through the fair, wreaking havoc as he went. When he could not sell, he bought. When he could not buy, he traded. And when he could not trade, he dredged for gossip and information. Some of the merchants, wiser than their fellows, saw him coming and promptly hid from him. Geryon, swept along by the little man's enthusiasm, began to understand his friend's fascination with this game, where profit was secondary to the satisfaction of besting an opponent. Silk's predations were broadly ecumenical. He was willing to deal with anyone. He met them all on their own ground. Tolnedrans, Errands, Kereks, fellow Drasnians, Sindars, all fell before him. By mid-afternoon he had disposed of all of what he had bought in Kamar. His full purse jingled, and the sack on Geryon's shoulder was still as heavy, but now it contained entirely new merchandise. Silk, however, was frowning. He walked along bouncing a small, exquisitely blown glass bottle on the palm of his hand. He had traded 2 ivory-bound books of Rassite verse to a Revan for the little bottle of perfume.
"What's the trouble?" Geryon asked him as they walked back toward Delvor's pavilions.
"I'm not sure who won," Silk told him shortly.
"What? I don't have any idea what this is worth."
"Well, why did you take it, then?"
"I didn't want him to know that I didn't know its value."
"We'll sell it to somebody else."
"How can I sell it if I don't know what to ask for it? If I ask too much, nobody will talk to me, and if I ask too little, I'll be laughed out of the fair."
Geryon started to chuckle.
"I don't see that it's all that funny, Geryon," Silk said sensitively.
He remained moody and irritable as they entered the pavilion.
"Here's the profit I promised you,"
he told Mr. Wolf somewhat ungraciously as he poured coins into the old man's hand.
"What's bothering you?"
Wolf asked, eyeing the little man's grumpy face.
"Nothing,"
Silk replied shortly. Then he glanced over at Aunt Paul, and a broad smile suddenly appeared on his face. He crossed to her and bowed.
"My dear Lady Palgora, please accept this trifling memento of my regard for you."
With a flourish, he presented the perfume bottle to her. Aunt Paul's look was a peculiar mixture of pleasure and suspicion. She took the small bottle and carefully worked out the tightly fitting stopper. Then, with a delicate gesture, she touched the stopper to the inside of her wrist and raised the wrist to her face to catch the fragrance.
"Why, Keldar," she exclaimed with delight, "this is a princely gift."
Silk's smile turned a bit sickly, and he peered sharply at her, trying to determine if she was serious or not. Then he sighed and went outside, muttering darkly to himself about the duplicity of ravens. Delvor returned not long afterward, dropping his striped cloak in one corner and held out his hand to one of the glowing braziers.
As nearly as I was able to find out, things are quiet between here and Fomimbre, he reported to Mr. Wolf. But 5 Murgos just rode into the fair with 2 dozen tolls behind them.
Hetar looked up quickly, his hawk face alert. Wolf frowned.
Did they come from the north or the south?
They claim to have come from Fomimbre, but there's red clay on the tolls' boots. I don't think there's any clay between here and Fomimbre, is there?
None, Mandorallan declared firmly. The only clay in the region is to the north. Wolf nodded. Get Silk back inside, he told Barak.
Barak went to the tent flap.
Couldn't it just be coincidence? Durnek wondered.
I don't think we want to take that chance, Wolf answered. We'll wait until the fair settles down for the night, and then slip away.
Silk came back inside, and he and Delvor spoke together briefly.
It won't take the Murgos long to find out we've been here, Barak rumbled, tugging thoughtfully at his red beard.
Then we'll have them dogging our heels every step of the way from here to Fomimbre. Wouldn't it simplify things if Hetar, Mandorallan, and I go pick a fight with them? 5 dead Murgos aren't going to follow anybody.
Hetar nodded with a certain dreadful eagerness.
I don't know if that would set too well with the Tonedrin legionnaires who police the fair, Silk drawled. Policemen seem to worry about unexplained bodies. It upsets their sense of neatness.
Barak shrugged.
It was a thought.
I think I've got an idea, Delvor said, pulling on his cloak again. They set up their tents near the pavilions of the Natrax. I'll go do some business with them.
He started toward the tent flap, then paused.
I don't know if it means anything, he told them, but I found out that the leader is a Murgo named Asherak.
Geryon felt a sudden chill at the mention of the name.
Barak whistled and looked suddenly very grim. We're going to have to attend to that one sooner or later, Delvarath, he declared.
You know him?
Delvor did not seem very surprised. We've met a time or two, Silk replied in an offhanded way.
He's starting to make a nuisance of himself,
Aunt Paul agreed.
I'll get started, Delvor said.
Geryon lifted the tent flap to allow Delvor to leave, but as he glanced outside, he let out a startled gasp and jerked the flap shut again.
What's the matter?
Silk asked.
I think I just saw Brill out there in the street.
Let me see, Durnek said.
His fingers parted the flap slightly, and he and Geryon both peered out. A slovenly figure loitered in the muddy street outside. Brell had not changed much since they had left Faldor's farm. His tunic and hose were still patched and stained, his face was still unshaven, and his cast eye still gleamed with a kind of unwholesome whiteness.
It's Brell, all right. Close enough for me to smell him.
Delvor looked at the smith inquiringly.
Brell bathes irregularly,
Durnek explained.
He's a fragrant sort of fella.
May I?
Delvor asked politely. He glanced out over Durnek's shoulder.
Oh, that one. He works for the Natrax. I thought that was a little strange, but he didn't seem so important, so I didn't bother to investigate.
Durnek, Wolf said quickly, step outside for a moment.
Make sure that he sees you.
But don't let him know that you know he's there. After he sees you, come back inside. Hurry. We don't want to let him get away.
Durnek looked baffled, but he lifted the tent flap and stepped out.
What are you up to, Father?
Aunt Paul asked rather sharply.
Don't just stand there smirking, old man. That's very irritating.
It's perfect,
Wolf chortled, rubbing his hands together. Durnek came back in, his face worried.
He saw me, he reported. Are you sure it's a good idea?
Of course, Wolf replied. Ashrak's obviously here because of us. It is going to be looking all over the fair for us.
Why make it easy for him, then?
We won't, Wolf replied. Ashrak's used Brill before, in Muros, remember? He brought Brill down here because Brill would recognize you or me or Durnik or Geryon. Probably Barak, too, and maybe Silk. Is he still out there?
Geryon peered out through the narrow opening. After a moment, he saw the unkempt Brill half-hidden between two tents across the street.
He's still there,
he answered.
We want to keep him there, Wolf said. We'll have to be sure that he doesn't get bored and go back to report to Ashrak that he's found us.
Silk looked at Delvor, and they both began to laugh.
What's so funny?
Barak demanded suspiciously.
You almost have to be a Drasnian to appreciate it, Silk replied.
He looked at Wolf admiringly.
Sometimes you amaze me, old friend.
Mr. Wolf winked at him.
Mondoralin confessed, That plan still escapes me.
May I? Silk asked Wolf.
He turned back to the knight.
It goes like this, Mondoralin. Ashrak's counting on Brill to find us for him. But as long as we keep Brill interested enough, he'll delay going back to tell Ashrak where we are. We've captured Ashrak's eyes, and that puts him at quite a disadvantage.
Mondoralin then asked,
But will this curious Sindar not follow us as soon as we leave the tent? When we ride from the fair, the Murkos will be immediately behind us.
The back wall of the tent is only canvas, Mondoralin, Silk pointed out gently. With a sharp knife, you can make as many doors in it as you like.
Delvor winced slightly, then sighed.
I'll go see the Murkos, he said. I think I can delay them even more.
Durnik and I will go out with you, Silk told his bald friend.
You go one way, we'll go another. Brill will follow us, and we can lead him back here.
Delvor nodded, and the three of them went out. Barak asked sourly,
Isn't this all unnecessarily complicated? Brill doesn't know Hethor. Why not just have Hethor slip out the back, circle around behind him, and stick a knife between his ribs? Then we could stuff him in a sack and drop him in a ditch somewhere after we leave the fair.
Wolf shook his head.
Ashrak would miss him, he replied. I want him to tell the Murkos that we are in this tent. With any luck, they'll sit outside for a day or so before they realize that we're gone.
For the next several hours, various members of the party went out into the street in front of the tent on short and wholly imaginary errands to hold the attention of the lurking Brill. When Geryon stepped out into the gathering darkness, he put on a show of unconcern, although his skin prickled as he felt Brill's eyes on him. He went into Delvor's supply tent and waited for several minutes. The noise from a tavern pavilion several rows of tents over seemed very loud in the growing stillness of the fair, as Geryon waited nervously in the dark supply tent. Finally, he drew a deep breath and went out again, one arm tucked up as if he were carrying something.
I found it, Durnik,
he announced as he re-entered the main pavilion.
There's no need to improvise, dear, Aunt Paul remarked. I just wanted to sound natural, he replied innocently.
Delvor returned soon after that, and they all waited in the warm tent as it grew darker outside and the streets emptied. Once it was fully dark, Delvor's porters pulled the packs out through a slit in the back of the tent. Silk, Delvor, and Hethar went with them to the horse pens on the outskirts of the fair, while the rest remained long enough to keep Brill from losing interest. In a final attempt at misdirection, Mr. Wolf and Barak went outside to discuss the probable conditions of the road to Prolgu and the Ogaland.
It might not work,
Wolf admitted, as he and the big red-bearded man came back inside.
Ashrek's sure to know that we are following Zadar south. But if Brill tells him that we're going to Prolgu, it might make him divide his forces to cover both roads.
He looked around the inside of the tent.
All right. Let's go.
One by one, they squeezed out through the slit in the back of the tent and crept into the next street. Then, walking at a normal pace, like serious people on honest business, they proceeded toward the horse pens. They passed the tavern pavilion, where several men were singing. The streets were mostly empty by now, and the night breeze brushed the city of tents, fluttering the pennons and banners. Then they reached the edge of the fair, where Silk, Delvor, and Hedhar waited with their mounts.
"Good luck," Delvor said as they prepared to mount. "I'll delay the Murgos for as long as I can."
Silk shook his friend's hand.
"I'd still like to know where you got those lead coins."
Delvor winked at him.
"What's this?"
Wolf asked.
"Delvor's got some Tolnedron crowns stamped out of lead and gilded over," Silk told him. "He hid some of them in the Murgos' tent, and tomorrow morning he's going to go to the Legionnaires with a few of them, and accuse the Murgos of passing them. When the Legionnaires search the Murgos' tent, they are sure to find the others."
"Money's awfully important to Tolnedrans," Barak observed. "If the Legionnaires get excited enough about those coins, they might start hanging people."
Delvor smirked. "Wouldn't that be a terrible shame?"
They mounted then, and rode away from the horse pens toward the highway. It was a cloudy night, and once they were out in the open, the breeze was noticeably brisk. Behind them, the fair gleamed and twinkled under the night sky like some vast city. Geryon drew his cloak about him. It was a lonely feeling to be on a dark road on a windy night, when everyone else in the world had a fire and a bed and walls around him. Then they reached the great west road, stretching pale and empty across the dark, rolling Arendish plain, and turned south again. Chapter 9. The wind picked up again shortly before dawn and was blowing briskly by the time the sky over the low foothills to the east began to lighten. Geryon was numb with exhaustion by then, and his mind had drifted into an almost dreamlike trance. The faces of his companions all seemed strange to him as the pale light began to grow stronger. At times he even forgot why they rode. He seemed caught in a company of grim-faced strangers pounding along a road to nowhere through a bleak, featureless landscape, with their wind-whipped cloaks flying dark behind them like the clouds scudding low and dirty overhead. A peculiar idea began to take hold of him. The strangers were somehow his captors, and they were taking him away from his real friends. The idea seemed to grow stronger the farther they rode, and he began to be afraid. Suddenly, without knowing why, he wheeled his horse and broke away, plunging off to the side of the road and across the open field beside it.
"Geryon!"
a woman's voice called sharply from behind, but he set his heels to his horse's flanks and sped even faster across the rough field. One of them was chasing him. A frightening man in black leather with a shaved head and a dark lock at his crown, flowing behind him in the wind. In a panic, Geryon kicked at his horse, trying to make the beast run even faster, but the fearsome rider behind him closed the gap quickly and seized the reins from his hands.
"What are you doing?"
he demanded harshly. Geryon stared at him, unable to answer. Then the woman in the blue cloak was there, and the others not far behind her. She dismounted quickly and stood looking at him with a stern face. She was tall for a woman, and her face was cold and imperious. Her hair was very dark, and there was a single white lock at her brow. Geryon trembled. The woman made him terribly afraid. "Get down off that horse," she commanded.
"Gently, Paul," a silvery-haired old man with an evil face said. A huge, red-bearded giant rode closer, threatening, and Geryon, almost sobbing with fright, slid down from the horse.
"Come here,"
the woman ordered.
Falteringly, Geryon approached her. "Give me your hand," she said. Hesitantly, he lifted his hand, and she took his wrist firmly.
She opened his fingers to reveal that ugly mark on his palm that he seemed to always have hated, and then put his hand against the white lock in her hair.
"Aunt Paul,"
he gasped, the nightmare suddenly dropping away. She put her arms about him tightly and held him for some time. Strangely, he was not even embarrassed by that display of affection in front of the others.
"This is serious, Father,"
she told Mr. Wolfe.
"What happened, Gerion?"
Wolfe asked, his voice calm.
"I don't know,"
Gerion replied.
"It was as if I didn't know any of you, and you were my enemies. And all I wanted to do was run away and try to get back to my real friends."
"Are you still wearing the amulet I gave you?"
"Yes."
"Have you had it off at any time since I gave it to you?"
"Well, just once," Gerion admitted. "When I took a bath in the Tol Nedrin hostel."
Wolfe sighed.
"You cannot take it off. Not ever. Not for any reason. Take it out from under your tunic."
Gerion drew out the silver pendant with the strange design. The old man took a medallion out from under his own tunic. It was very bright, and there was upon it the figure of a standing wolf, so lifelike that it looked almost ready to lope away. Aunt Paul, her one arm still about Gerion's shoulders, drew a similar amulet out of her bodice. Upon the disc of her medallion was the figure of an owl.
"Hold it in your right hand, dear,"
she instructed, firmly closing Gerion's fingers over the pendant. Then, holding her amulet in her own right hand, she placed her left hand over his closed fist. Wolfe, also holding his talisman, put his hand on theirs. Gerion's palm began to tingle, as if the pendant were suddenly alive. Mr. Wolfe and Aunt Paul looked at each other for a long moment, and the tingling in Gerion's hand suddenly became very strong. His mind seemed to open, and strange things flickered before his eyes. He saw a round room very high up somewhere. A fire burned, but there was no wood in it. At a table there was seated an old man who looked somewhat like Mr. Wolfe, but obviously was someone else. He seemed to be looking directly at Gerion, and his eyes were kindly, even affectionate. Gerion was suddenly overwhelmed with a consuming love for this old man.
"That should be enough," Wolfe judged, releasing Gerion's hand.
"Who was the old man?"
Gerion asked.
"My master," Wolfe replied.
"What happened?"
Durnick asked, his face concerned.
"It's probably better not to talk about it,"
Aunt Paul said.
"Do you think you could build a fire? It's time for breakfast."
"There's some trees over there. Well, we can get out of the wind,"
Durnick suggested. They all remounted and rode toward the trees. After they had eaten, they sat by the small fire for a while. They were tired, and none of them felt quite up to facing the blustery morning again. Gerion felt particularly exhausted, and he wished that he were young enough to sit close beside Aunt Paul and perhaps put his head in her lap and sleep, as he had done when he was very young. The strange thing that had happened made him feel very much alone, and more than a little frightened.
"Durnick,"
he said, more to drive the mood away than out of any real curiosity.
"What sort of bird is that?"
he pointed.
"A raven, I think,"
Durnick answered, looking at the bird circling above them.
"I thought so too," Gerion said. "But they don't usually circle, do they?"
Durnick frowned.
Maybe it's watching something on ground."
"How long has it been up there?"
Wolfe asked, squinting up at the large bird.
"I think I first saw it when we were crossing the field."
Mr. Wolfe glanced over at Aunt Paul.
"What do you think?"
She looked up from one of Gerion's stockings she had been mending.
"I'll see."
Her face took on a strange, probing expression. Gerion felt a peculiar tingling again. On an impulse, he tried to push his own mind out toward the bird.
"Gerion," Aunt Paul said, without looking at him, "stop that." "I'm sorry,"
he apologized quickly, and pulled his mind back where it belonged. Mr. Wolfe looked at him with a strange expression, then winked at him.
"It's Kamdar,"
Aunt Paul announced calmly. She carefully pushed her needle into the stocking and set it aside. Then she stood up and shook off her blue cloak.
"What have you got in mind?" Wolf asked.
"I think I'll go have a little chat with him," she replied, flexing her fingers like talons.
"You'd never catch him," Wolf told her. "Your feathers are too soft for this kind of wind. There is an easier way."
The old man swept the windy sky with a searching gaze.
"Over there."
He pointed at a barely visible speck above the hills to the west.
"You had better do it, Paul. I don't get along with birds."
"Of course, Father," she agreed. She looked intently at the speck, and Garion felt the tingle as she sent her mind out again. The speck began to circle, rising higher and higher, until it disappeared. The raven did not see the plummeting eagle until the last instant, just before the larger bird's talons struck. There was a sudden puff of black feathers, and the raven, screeching with fright, flapped wildly away with the eagle in hot pursuit.
"Nicely done, Paul," Wolf approved.
"It will give him something to think about," she smiled. "Don't stare, Durnick." Durnick was gaping at her, his mouth open.
"How did you do that?"
"Do you really want to know?" she asked. Durnick shuddered and looked away quickly.
"I think that just about settles it," Wolf said. "Disguises are probably useless now. I'm not sure what Kamdar's up to, but he's going to be watching us every step of the way. And we might as well arm ourselves and ride straight on to Vomimbre." "Aren't we going to follow the trail anymore?" Beric asked. "The trail goes south," Wolf replied. "I can pick it up again once we cross over into Tol Nedra. But first I want to stop by and have a word with King Coradulan. There are some things he needs to know."
"Coradulan?" Durnick looked puzzled.
"Wasn't that the name of the first Erendish king? Seems to me somebody told me that once."
"All Erendish kings are named Coradulan," Silk told him. "And the queens are all named Maya Serena. It's all part of the fiction the royal family here maintains to keep the kingdom from flying apart. They have to marry as closely within the bloodline as possible to maintain the illusion of the unification of the houses of Mimbre and Asturia. It makes them all a bit sickly, but there's no help for it, considering the peculiar nature of Erendish politics." "All right, Silk," Aunt Paul said reprovingly.
Mandor Allan looked thoughtful. "Could it be that this Kamdar, who so dogs our steps, is one of great substance in this dark society of the Grolems?" he asked.
"He'd like to be," Wolf answered. "Zadar and Tuchik are Torek's disciples, and Kamdar wants to be one as well. He has always been Tuchik's agent, but he may believe that this is his chance to move up in the Grolem hierarchy. Krochik's very old, and he spends all of his time in the Temple of Turak at Raktul. Maybe Kamdar thinks it's time that someone else become High Priest."
"Is Turak's body at Raktul?" Silk asked quickly. Mr. Wolf shrugged.
"Nobody knows for sure, but I doubt it. After Zadar carried him away from the battlefield at Vomimbre, I don't think he'd have just handed him over to Kduchik. He could be in Meloria, or somewhere in the southern reaches of Kral Murgos. It's hard to say.
But at the moment, Kamdar's the one we have to worry about," Silk concluded.
"Not if we keep moving," Wolf replied.
"We'd better get moving, then,"
Beric said, standing up. By mid-morning, the heavy clouds had begun to break up, and patches of blue sky showed here and there. Enormous pillars of sunlight stalked ponderously across the rolling fields that waited, damp and expectant, for the first touches of spring. With Mandor Allan in the lead, they had ridden hard and had covered a good 6 leagues. Finally, they slowed to a walk to allow their steaming horses to rest.
"How much further is it to Vomimbre, Grandfather?"
Garion asked, pulling his horse in beside Mr. Wolf.
60 leagues, at least, Wolf answered. Probably closer to 80.
That's a long way,
Geryon winced as he shifted in his saddle.
Yes.
I'm sorry I ran away like that back there,
Geryon apologized. It wasn't your fault. Tamda was playing games.
But why did he pick me? Couldn't he have done the same thing to Durnik or Beric?
Mr. Wolf looked at him.
You're younger. More susceptible.
That's not really it, is it?
Geryon accused.
No, Wolf admitted. Not really. But it is an answer of sorts.
This is another one of those things you aren't going to tell me, isn't it?
I suppose you could say that,
Wolf answered blandly. Geryon sulked about that for a while, but Mr. Wolf rode on, seemingly unconcerned by the boy's reproachful silence. They stopped that night at a Tolnedron hostel, which, like all of them, was plain, adequate, and expensive. The next morning the sky had cleared, except for billowy patches of white clouds scampering before the brisk wind. The sight of the sun made them all feel better, and there was even some bantering between Silk and Barak as they rode along, something Geryon had not heard in all of the weeks they had spent traveling under the gloomy skies of northern Arendia. Mundurallan, however, scarcely spoke that morning, and his face grew more somber with each passing mile. He was not wearing his armor, but instead a mail suit and a deep blue surcoat. His head was bare, and the wind tugged at his curly hair. On a nearby hilltop, a bleak-looking castle brooded down at them as they passed, its grim walls high and haughty-looking. Mundurallan seemed to avoid looking at it, and his face became even more melancholy. Geryon found it difficult to make up his mind about Mundurallan. He was honest enough with himself to admit that much of his thinking was still clouded by Laldaran's prejudices. He didn't really want to like Mundurallan, but aside from the habitual gloominess which seemed characteristic of all Arans, and the studied and involuted archaisms of the old man's speech and his towering self-confidence, there seemed little actually to dislike. A half-league along the road from the castle, a ruin sat at the top of a long rise. It was not much more than a single wall with a high archway in the center and broken columns on either side. Near the ruin, a woman sat on horseback, her dark red cape flowing in the wind. Without a word, almost without seeming to think about it, Mundurallan turned his war horse from the road and cantered up the rise toward the woman, who watched his approach without any seeming surprise, but also with no particular pleasure.
"Where's he going?"
Beric asked.
"She's an acquaintance of his,"
Mr. Wolf said dryly.
"Are we supposed to wait for them?"
"He can catch up with us." Mundurallan had stopped his horse near the woman and dismounted. He bowed to her and held out his hands to help her down from her horse. They walked together toward the ruin, not touching, but walking very close to each other. They stopped beneath the archway and talked. Behind the ruin, clouds raced in the windy sky, and their enormous shadows swept uncaring across the mournful fields of Arendia.
"We should have taken a different route." "I wasn't thinking, I guess," Wolf said.
"Is there some problem?"
Durnik asked.
"Nothing unusual in Arendia," Wolf answered. "I suppose it is my fault. Sometimes I forget the kinds of things that can happen to young people."
"Don't be cryptic, Father," Aunt Paul told him. "It's very irritating. Is this something we should know about?"
Wolf shrugged.
It isn't any secret. Half of Arendia knows about it. A whole generation of Arendish virgins cry themselves to sleep every night over it."
"Father,"
Aunt Paul snapped exasperatedly.
"Right," Wolf said.
"When Mundurallan was about Geryon's age, he showed a great deal of promise. Strong, courageous, not too bright. The qualities that make a good knight. His father asked me for advice, and I made arrangements for the young man to live for a while with the Baron of Voebor. That's his castle back there.
The Baron had an enormous reputation, and he provided Mandurallan with the kind of instruction he needed. Mandurallan and the Baron became almost like father and son, since the Baron was quite a bit older. Everything was going along fine until the Baron got married. His bride, however, was much younger, about Mandurallan's age.
I think I see where this is going,
Durnick remarked disapprovingly. Not exactly, Wolf disagreed. After the honeymoon, the Baron returned to his customary nightly pursuits and left a very bored young lady wandering around his castle. It is a situation with all kinds of interesting possibilities. Anyway, Mandurallan and the lady exchanged glances, then words, the usual sort of thing.
It happens in Sindaria, too, Durnick observed. I'm sure the name we have for it's very different from the one they use here.
His tone was becoming critical, even offended. You're jumping to conclusions, Durnick, Wolf told him. Things never went any further. It might have been better if they had. Adultery isn't really all that serious, and in time they'd have gotten bored with it. But since they both loved and respected the Baron too much to dishonor him, Mandurallan left the castle before things could get out of hand. Now they both suffer in silence. Oh, it's all very touching, but it seems like a waste of time to me. Of course I am older.
You are older than everyone, Father, Aunt Paul said.
You didn't have to say that, Paul.
Silk laughed sardonically. I am glad to see that our stupendous friend at least has the bad taste to fall in love with another man's wife. His nobility was beginning to get rather cloying.
The little man's expression had that bitter self-mocking cast to it Geryon had first seen in Val Alorn when they had spoken with Queen Porin.
Does Baron know about it?
Durnick asked.
Naturally,
Wolf replied.
That's the part that makes the Arryns get all mushy inside about it. There was a knight once, stupider than most Arryns, who made a bad joke about it. The Baron promptly challenged him and ran a lance through him during the duel. Since then, very few people have found the situation humorous.
Aye, still disgraceful,
Durnick said.
Their behavior is above reproach, Durnick, Aunt Paul maintained firmly. There is no shame in it as long as it does not go any further.
Decent people done a lot that in the first place,
Durnick asserted.
You'll never convince her, Durnick, Mr. Wolf told the smith. Volgrad spent too many years associating with the Varsite Errands. They were as bad or worse than the Membrates. You cannot wallow in that kind of sentimentality for that long without some of it rubbing off. Fortunately, it hasn't totally blotted out her good sense. She's only occasionally girlish and gushy. If you can avoid her during those seizures, it's almost as if there's nothing wrong with her.
My time was spent a little more usefully than yours, Father, Aunt Paul observed acidly. As I remember, you spent those years carousing in the waterfront dives in Kamar. And then there was that uplifting period you spent amusing the depraved women of Meragor. I am certain those experiences broadened your concept of morality enormously.
Mr. Wolf coughed uncomfortably and looked away. Behind them, Mandurallan had remounted and begun to gallop back down the hill. The lady stood in the archway with her red cloak billowing in the wind, watching him as he rode away. They were 5 days on the road before they reached the river Arend, the boundary between Arendia and Tolnedra. The weather improved as they moved farther south, and by the morning, when they reached the hill overlooking the river, it was almost warm. The sun was very bright, and a few fleecy clouds raced overhead in the fresh breeze.
Mandurallan remarked, "The high road to Volmembre branches to the left just there."
"Yes," Wolf said. "Let's go down into that grove near the river, make ourselves a bit more presentable.
Appearances are very important in Vomimbre, and we don't want to arrive looking like vagabonds. Three brown-robed and hooded figures stood humbly at the crossroads, their faces down and their hands held out in supplication. Mr. Wolf reined in his horse and approached them. He spoke with them briefly, then gave each a coin.
"Who are they?" Garion asked.
"Monks from Mar Terran," Silk replied.
"And where's that?"
"It's a monastery in southeastern Toledra, where Meregor used to be," Silk told him. "The monks try to comfort the spirits of the Meregs." Mr. Wolf motioned to them, and they rode on past the three humble figures at the roadside.
"They say that no Murgos have passed here in the last 2 weeks. Are you sure that you can believe them?" "Probably. The monks won't lie to anybody."
"Then they'll tell anybody who comes by that we have passed here?"
Wolf nodded.
"They'll answer any question anyone puts to them."
"That's an unsavory habit,"
Beric grunted darkly. Mr. Wolf shrugged and led the way among the trees beside the river.
"This ought to do,"
he decided, dismounting in a grassy glade. He waited while the others climbed down from their horses.
"All right,"
he told them.
"We're going to Vomimbre. I want you all to be careful about what you say while we're there. Membrates are very touchy, and the slightest word could be taken as an insult."
Aunt Paul interrupted. "I think you should wear the white robe Thorak gave you, Father."
"Please, Paul," Wolf said. "I'm trying to explain something."
"I heard you, Father," she said, pulling open one of the packs. "You tend to belabor things too much."
She held up the white robe and looked at it critically.
"You should have folded it more carefully. You've wrinkled it."
"I am not going to wear that thing."
"Yes, you are, Father. We might have to argue about it for an hour or two, but you'll wind up wearing it in the end anyway. Why not just save yourself all of the time and aggravation?"
"It's silly."
"Lots of things are silly, Father. I know the errands better than you do. You'll get more respect if you look the part. Mandorallan and Hetar and Barak will wear their armor. Durnik and Silk and Garion can wear the doublets Folak gave them in Sindar. I'll be wearing my blue gown, and you will wear the white robe. I insist, Father."
"You what? Now, listen here, Balgara."
"Be still, Father,"
she said absently, examining Garion's blue doublet. Wolf's face darkened, and his eyes bulged dangerously.
"Was there something else?"
she asked with a level gaze. Mr. Wolf let it drop.
"He's as wise as they say he is," Silk observed.
An hour later they were on the high road to Vomimbre, under a sunny sky. Mandorallan, once again in full armor and with a blue and silver pennon streaming from the tip of his lance, led the way, with Barak in his gleaming mail shirt and black bearskin cape riding immediately behind him. At Aunt Paul's insistence, the big Kerach had combed the tangles out of his red beard and even rebraided his hair. Mr. Wolf, in his white robe, rode sourly, muttering to himself, and Aunt Paul set her horse demurely at his side in a short fur-lined cape and with a blue satin headdress surmounting the heavy mass of her dark hair. Garion and Durnik were ill at ease in their finery, but Silk wore his doublet and black velvet cap with a kind of exuberant flair. Hadar's sole concession to formality had been the replacement of a ring of beaten silver for the leather thong, which usually caught in his scalp lock. The serfs and even the occasional knight they encountered along the way stood aside and saluted respectfully. The day was warm, the road was good, and their horses were strong. By mid-afternoon they crested a high hill, overlooking the plain which sloped down to the gates of Vomimbre. Chapter 10 The city of the Membrate Arons reared almost like a mountain beside the sparkling river. Its thick, high walls were surmounted by massive battlements, and great towers and slender spires with bright banners at their tips rose within the walls, gleaming golden in the afternoon sun.
"Behold, Vomimbre,"
Mandarallan proclaimed with pride. Queen of cities! Upon that rock the tide of Angrak crashed and recoiled and crashed again. Upon this field they met their ruin. The soul and pride of Orendia doth reside within that fortress, and the power of the Dark One may not prevail against it.
We have been here before, Mandarallan, Mr. Wolfe said sourly.
Don't be impolite, father,
Aunt Paul said to the old man. Then she turned to Mandarallan, and to Geryon's amazement she spoke in an idiom he had never heard from her lips before.
Wilt thou, Sir Knight, convey us presently into the palace of thy king? We must needs take counsel with him in matters of gravest urgency.
She delivered this without the least trace of self-consciousness, as if the archaic formality came quite naturally to her.
For as much as thou art the mightiest living knight, we place ourselves under the protection of thy arm.
Mandarallan, after a startled instant, slid with a crash from his war-horse and sank to his knees before her.
My Lady Polgara,
he replied in a voice throbbing with respect, with reverence even.
I accept thy charge, and will convey thee safely unto King Coradulan. Should any man question thy paramount right to the king's attention, I shall prove his folly upon his body.
Aunt Paul smiled at him encouragingly, and he vaulted into the saddle with a clang and led the way at a rolling trot, his whole bearing seething with a willingness to do battle.
What was that all about?
Wolfe asked.
Mandarallan needed something to take his mind off of his troubles, she replied. He has been out of sorts for the last few days.
As they drew closer to the city, Geryon could see the scars on the great walls where heavy stones from the Angorak catapults had struck the unyielding rock. The battlements high above were chipped and pitted from the impact of showers of steel-tipped arrows. The stone archway that led into the city revealed the incredible thickness of the walls, and the iron-bound gate was massive. They clattered through the archway and into the narrow, crooked streets. The people they passed seemed, for the most part, to be commoners, who quickly moved aside. The faces of the men in dun-colored tunics and the women in patched dresses were dull and uncurious.
They don't seem very interested in us, Geryon commented quietly to Durnick.
I don't think the ordinary people and the gentry pay much attention to each other here,
Durnick replied.
Well, they live side by side, but they don't know anything about each other. Maybe that is what's wrong with Orendia.
Geryon nodded soberly. Although the commoners were indifferent, the nobles at the palace seemed afire with curiosity. Word of the party's entrance into the city apparently had raced ahead of them through the narrow streets, and the windows and parapets of the palace were alive with people in brightly colored clothes.
"A bit thy pace, Sir Knight,"
a tall man with dark hair and beard wearing a black velvet surcoat over his polished mail called down from the parapet to Mandarallan as they clattered into the broad plaza before the palace.
"Lift thy visor, so I may know thee."
Mandarallan stopped in amazement before the closed gate and raised his visor.
"What discourtesy is this?" he demanded. I am, as all the world knows, Mandarallan, Baron of Omandor. Surely thou canst see my crest upon the face of my shield?
Any man may wear another's crest, the man above declared disdainfully. Mandarallan's face darkened.
Art thou not mindful that no man on life would dare to counterfeit my semblance?
He asked with dangerous tones.
Sir Andrig, another knight on the parapet told the dark-haired man, this is indeed Sir Mandarallan. I met him on the field of the great tourney last year, and our meeting cost me a broken shoulder and put ringing in my ears which has not yet subsided.
Huh? Sir Andrig replied.
Since thou wilt vouch for him, Sir Halbergren, I will admit that this is indeed the bastard of Omandor.
Beric said quietly to Mandarallan,
you're going to have to do something about that one of these days.
It was seems so, Mandarallan replied.